What is up, everyone? You are back with Citywide Blackout, your home for music, movies, and more. I'm your host, Max Bowen. Now, recently, I got the chance to check out the brand new comic, Shy Ninja, and I loved it. So much so that I had to have the writer on to talk all about it. So, comic veteran Ricardo Sanchez joined me, and we talked all about the story, which was developed by his daughter, Adara, who also helped out with the art for the series. We go into how the series came to be, the story behind it, which focuses on ninjas in the modern era. It's a great concept. And we look at how this father and daughter team came together and made this thing happen. Writer of the brand new Shy Ninja graphic novel released on June 1st through Humanoids, Rick Sanchez joins me. Rick, welcome to the show, man. It's so cool to have you here, and I am loving the comic.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here. Really excited. And, Shy Ninja has been a true labor of love. And so I could not thank you more for the opportunity to talk about it.
All right. This comic began with your daughter, Adara. She came up with a whole concept. How did it go from an idea to something that you said, okay, I want to write this?
Very circuitously. We were on our way to San Diego Comic-Con, and I was going with the intent to pitch ideas to a number of different editors, among them my editor at Humanoids. And, we're just chatting, and she's kind of ignoring me and doodling on her iPad. And, I'm practicing my pitches on her, and then I'm asking her, what are you working on? And then she tells me about one of these ideas of hers, which is this world that included Shy Ninja. And the second she told me about a girl who decides to take an online correspondence course to become a ninja because she's shy, it was just one of those ideas that instantly hits me like, man, I wish I would have thought of it. I wish that was my idea.
Why did I think of that, you're thinking, right?
Yeah, it was just so perfect. And she has lots of ideas like that where she just, noodles on them. And we talk about it a little bit, and then we're, back to the music and driving and getting down there. And when I'm talking to my editor, I'm pitching him my ideas. I pitch him maybe 9 or 10 things that I've been working on that I really wanted to write. He's like, no, been done, been there, got something similar. No, thank you. And finally, he's like, what we're really interested in right now is something more reality based, like a little bit more real, maybe something kid oriented. And I'm thinking, I wonder how mad my daughter will be if I mention Shy Ninja. So I'm very upfront saying, it's my daughter's idea, but she has this idea for, Shy Ninja. What do you think of that? And the editor had the exact same response. Instantaneous. That's brilliant. We need to make that comic book. Wow. And shut down everything I wanted to do, but my daughter, he's totally on board with. So afterwards, I tell my daughter, she's actually a big fan of his, like some of the comics he's done. And it takes a while, honestly, to convince her and put together a new pitch around it for them. So I think it was maybe even almost a full another year before we went from that to really working on the comic book and making it real. But it was all because of my failure as a writer that we were able to do this.
Jeez. Well, that's dark. Jeez.
Oh, no, it all works out in the end.
Exactly. Hey, you know what, though? If those ideas hadn't failed, this idea couldn't succeed.
Exactly.
And now your daughter gets credit for story developer, basically.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been an incredible opportunity for her. She worked with me on the plot, on the characters. She helped me with some of the story sequences and things. And so it was a great experience for both of us. I'm so grateful both that I got to do the project, but that I got to do it with her.
Excellent. Now, did she contribute to like the line writing, or was it more like concept, idea, plot?
Predominantly plot. So we worked together on an outline. She helped me develop a number of the characters in there. So there's a few villains, nothing over the top. Very still reality based, but she helped me come up with some of those characters. And then I wrote from the outline that we developed together. I wrote the actual script. And then once I had that, she read it and then, gave me feedback on it like a good collaborator would, and, changed some lines, many of which made it, all the way through to the final version based on her input.
Were there any times where she would like read your lines and be like, Dad, that's no good. Do it again.
Oh, absolutely. So the story has a number of teenage kids in it, naturally. And there were a couple of scenes that I wrote that were probably just too adult in perspective, by which I don't mean that it was adult material, just not the way a kid would react to a situation. And so she kept me very grounded and kept the characters very, very real to their age in a way I might not have been able to do by myself.
Because I find that teenagers and adults, we do not speak the same language anymore. It's total just difference.
Yeah, there's that's definitely true. Now, the good news for me is that I spend, especially thanks to the pandemic, lots of time with her. So my vocabulary and thought process may have you know, risen to teenage level, as a way to put it. But she definitely kept the characters very grounded in reality.
All right. And I know that she also did some of the concept art, too, because I saw that at the back of the comic. And amazing talent. I was floored.
Yeah, you know, my daughter, she kind of decided, I mean, a lot of kids decide, you know, when they're three, I want to draw. And so they're drawing, you know, for years and years and years, and maybe they continue to do so. Adara came to it a little later and just came to it with a very different perspective than a lot of kids. She didn't try to recreate reality, like a very non-realist approach. And so she's managed to develop a style that's pretty uniquely hers. Like I can look at a body of different images and I can pick hers out, you know, in a heartbeat. One of the cool things for her was that she got to put her, you know, her own Shy Ninja art into the book and then other stuff from her own portfolio, which is pretty awesome.
Mm-hmm. And for like the series itself, you worked with artist Ariana Florian. And she has worked on a number of different titles, Zootopia, Frozen. So Shy Ninja really just seems like the perfect thing for her. How did she come to be like a part of the team?
Yeah, I wish I could take any credit for it, but I owe the editor of the book like a huge debt of gratitude for this. He almost immediately thought of her as the perfect complement to the story idea, and I think that she just did a phenomenal job of capturing the kids' expressions and emotion. And, you know, part of the premise of the story is the main character, Reina Shy Ninja, has social anxiety disorder. And because of that, you know, she does have a wide range of emotions through the book, a little bit more than you might expect if it was kind of like a typical teenage hero story. And, I think she did a really incredible job of making Reina feel like a real person.
I was really curious about that because you have Reina with her social anxiety disorder, and you also have her friend Sydney, who has, I think I'm correct on this one, a severe combined immunodeficiency, which means he has to live in a sealed environment. Why incorporate characters with these conditions in a story? How does that, I guess, like fit into the universe of Shy Ninja?
So there's a couple reasons that came to be. The core of it, though, always comes back to Reina. Reina's the main character. And as a writer, I built everything else around her. In her case, I thought it was just really interesting to write a character who has social anxiety, who's a teenager, who has to deal with all of the challenges that accompany that. But I wanted to do it in a way that was both realistic, that didn't... that did not treat the condition as a gimmick for why she would be a Shy Ninja. I wanted it to be both a source of strength, like why would she be a ninja, as well as something for her to overcome. And so I also, though, needed to give her friends. I did not want to make her a completely isolated person. But given her condition, it would be really hard for her to make friends. And as I was thinking about, you know, who might be the friend of a kid like this, I don't know why like it came to Adara and I, but we were talking and the idea of her opposite being a good best friend is what led to our boy in a bubble, where Reina doesn't want to go out. She would rather stay home and away from other people and like almost fight to be isolated. Her friend Sydney is forced to stay home. He can't leave if he wants to, and is jealous of her ability to leave, and not resentful, but conflicted about how she won't. And so it drives both characters to grow over the course of the story.
Speaking of which, the story itself, I love like the intertwining of reality and fantasy. You have Master Dysart. He is sort of like the head of this like ninja council, and he's facing the reality that ninjas have become a joke. They become like pop culture icons and video game characters and Halloween costumes, but the ninja culture is just gone, basically. Enter Reyna, who he tells her she is the mysterious ghost. She is sort of like the prodigal child who can bring back ninja culture, who is like destined to be the greatest ninja of all time. Or is she? I'll leave it there because you got to read it. But I loved how there was kind of like a balance of real life and actions. This wasn't just like a ninja battle story. Was that the plan going into it? And how'd you kind of keep that balance?
You know, one of the very first things that, you know, was put to me when I was thinking about writing up this narrative was humanoids did want to keep things more grounded in reality than not. They were not looking for a superhero story. And I don't know that I necessarily would have written it differently anyway, but with that as an input, it did mean that as I was thinking about Reyna growing as a ninja, I had to do so in a way that felt real. Like, so she could not perform, you know, amazing feats of acrobatic, you know, wonderfulness that no normal person could do without the help of CG. And it also was an interesting creative construct for me to work in. So I had to think through every problem from the perspective of, you know, what obstacles can I put in front of her that she could realistically overcome to a degree. I mean, it is still a comic book.
Yeah, exactly. And the different ninja techniques that she learns, it's less, you know, like magic and such. It's more just like misdirection, hiding, stealth and such. A lot of research into these techniques.
Yes and no. I have to confess that I have been in love with all things ninja since I was a kid in the 80s. Because, you know, the 80s was the decade of ninja movies. Most of the ninjas were evil, but they were still pretty cool. And ever since then, I've you know, just picked up a lot of things about ninjas. But I did do research to make sure that what I knew was factually accurate. So when you come across anything that's ninja related, except for the story of the ghost, which is the prophecy that she's, you know, potentially living up to, everything else is pretty much based in fact. So the eras of when ninjas were in power, their fall from power, the techniques she learns, the way they're used, even the way that she employs them in dealing with the problems that she has to solve, all of that comes back to how ninjas really did work and behave in feudal Japan.
I like that because it definitely had an air of reality about it. So I'm going to guess that writing a ninja story is kind of like a dream come true for you.
Oh, absolutely. It was a ton of fun. I never thought this would be the ninja story I'd write, you know, but I'm glad that it was because it was it made me really think about what would it be like to be a modern ninja? Why would you even be one? The missions that Reyna takes on in the story, I think, are like an interesting balance to, you know, how do you take these very, very old school techniques that are not about technology and apply them to a world that is surrounded with technology?
How did you do that?
Well, misdirection, hiding in plain sight, all the things ninjas are famous for, standing still. There's dozens of ways to stand still without being seen, for example. In fact, that's one of the things that Reyna has to learn very early on is she has to learn to stand.
Now, you've worked in comics for a number of years. You've worked with a number of titles. What would you say the character of Reyna and the story of Shy Ninja kind of brings to the comic universe?
I think one of the things that Shy Ninja brings to the comic universe is a pretty realistic view of mental health in teens. So I don't think that her character is particularly innovative in itself. I mean, there's lots of kids who do lots of interesting things in comics. But often when any sort of mental health issue is brought up, it's often demonized or it's a gimmick or it's resolved at the end of the story. The character is cured. And in reality, that's not the way mental health works. Mental health, you know, some maybe you get cured, but more often than not, it's something that you learn to manage. And that was important to me that I accurately portray that and that it be something that kids could see in comic form, and whether or not they themselves have issues, they may know someone who does. And they could see this and have a very grounded view of it. So, you know, I wish I could say that I think that I invented like a really amazing character that is truly unique in the world of comicdom, but I don't know that I did. I think maybe what I did was just bring this perspective to comics, which isn't seen often enough.
Yeah, definitely. Because normally the heroes, whoever they are, they're always perfect in some fashion. You know, like they face the challenge, they overcome the challenge, they stumble a bit, but they always get there. Reyna, from what I can see, she stumbles a lot. I mean, she does learn things and she does overcome the challenges. But I think this is a pretty human character, basically.
That was the goal. Like from the start, I wanted her to be as human as possible. I wanted kids to see her even at the end and go, "That's not absurd." That, you know, that's I can believe this.
Exactly. One thing you mentioned that kind of caught me was when her condition, there is no cure for her, basically. It is something that she will deal with forever. And in fact, there's one scene where she says, "Oh, I'm cured." And her therapist is like, "No, that's not how this works. There's you get better with it, but there's not an actual end point, really." Do you feel like that's a really significant part to the story? Does it kind of hammer home what you were just saying?
I think it is. Raina's largely, I don't want to say in denial, but she doesn't accept that there is a better path than the one that she was on, which is just saying, I don't want to go out and I like it better that way. And so her saying, "Oh, I'm cured," is kind of that same head in the sand approach to her problem. And as the story progresses, you know, she progresses and then she stumbles. And I think that without that moment of her, you know, falsely thinking, I'm done, it's harder to internalize as the reader that this progress is progress and stumbles and progress and stumbles, and that there is no end to this particular through line.
Do you feel like Dysart is really a villain in this story? Because it seems he's kind of back and forth a little bit to me.
Well, without giving too much away, mm-hmm. I would say that, yeah, he's a mixed bag. On the one hand, he's doing Reyna a huge favor. On the other hand, he has an agenda of his own for which he is using Reyna. And as the story progresses out, you know, with all things human, not all of our agendas align perfectly. She has needs that go one direction. He has needs that go another. And then that's where the dramatic tension comes from. And that's how we come up with a problem for the two of them to have to overcome together or not together.
Story-wise, was there any back and forth between you and Adara in terms of like, okay, does this work? No. Do something else? No. That kind of stuff?
Yeah, there was. All throughout primarily the outlining period. It's easier for me at least to do a really thorough outline before I start to write. All throughout the outlining, you know, we would look at the ideas together, the characters, the scenes, and she would tell me, "Yeah, kids don't do that." Like, there were several scenes like that I just had to take out because she was just flat out, "Kids do not do this. You've been watching too much TV." And so there was a good back and forth there. And I mean, it comes back to, like I said, like the dialogue that she helped me with, thinking about the characters. She makes the teenagers in Shy Ninja very real.
Would you say that these parts, like the parts where it's just Reyna living her life and interacting with like her mom and Sydney, are these like just as important to the story as the action and her training and becoming a ninja?
I definitely think they are. One of the things that I think that we get a lot in origin stories, and in a lot of ways, this is an origin story, is that the character is put into some forcing function where they have to grow really quickly and really fast and really hard in order to overcome some terrible thing. And I even have a line in the book where Reyna kind of poo-poos the notion of there being such a thing as a chosen one, because I think we've all seen too much of it. And so having these moments where, you know, she's connecting with her mom or not connecting with her mom just as often, and where she's very much leaning into easier not to go out than to try and go out, are important, because then when she does make progress, whether it's forced on her through ninja training or whether she just gets there on her own through adaptation and growth, those moments are what make that growth feel believable to the reader and significant to the reader.
When it comes to her condition, did you speak to someone who is also dealing with social anxiety disorder or do a lot of research on the topic?
A little bit of both. I know someone who has it, and I did talk to a therapist to make sure that I understood, you know, how exactly would a therapist approach a teenager with this versus an adult? What kinds of emotions would teenagers have if they had this kind of problem? It was like I said, it was very important to me that this be accurate and that I not make it a gimmick. And like, while I can't honestly say that I have these personal problems or even that Adara does, that it's in any way biographical, I did make sure that it was real and that I had a therapist friend who looked at the script before we started working on the art. And, you know, she basically vetted it for me to make sure that what I wrote jived with reality, that it wasn't, you know, something you'd see on TV where they kind of blurred the lines about what someone might really go through.
Like you said before, too often it's just used as a tool. It's there, but it's kind of exploited to make the character sympathetic or someone that the audience will root for. But clearly you don't know what it is you're writing about. And I think it's good that you at least took the time to properly vet it.
Yeah. I mean, you'll often see writers use things like mental health as a shortcut, that they don't want to take the time to develop out the real reasons for a character to do something. And so they throw in, oh, well, this character is a psychopath, or, oh, this character, you know, has this problem and therefore they behave this way. In this particular case, even though the social anxiety disorder is an important part of Raina's story, it's just a part of it. You know, the bulk of the activity is influenced by it and flavored by it because it's who she is. But it's just a piece of her. And so, you know, she likes video games. She likes movies. She eventually becomes, you know, someone who really embraces her abilities as a ninja. She's a good friend. She's occasionally a bad daughter. You know, she's all of these wonderful things. And the social anxiety is just part of it. And by making sure that it was realistic, it's able to be just a part of her as opposed to like a veneer that defines her.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel like Shy Ninja is a series with a message, or is it more just for fun?
From my perspective, it's for fun. You can find a message in it, but that's not why it exists. So I wrote the story very purposely just to write a really fun ninja story for kids. I do just also believe that when you bring more realistic themes to a story, that it adds to that enjoyment value because it makes characters more complex. It brings more texture to the story. So even though there is, you know, I think a valuable theme in how she approaches her social anxiety disorder, it is not a comic book with a message. It is a comic book that is intended for you to have a good time with. And if you happen to pick up on a little bit of empathy in the way, that's not such a bad thing.
There you go. Now, you mentioned earlier that this all started with a trip to the San Diego Comic-Con. Now,
yeah.
I know that I know the cons are starting to return. Some are being planned for the fall. Do you plan to go to some as a presenter?
Yeah. There is one in San Jose in August. And what was it? It's gone through so many names changes now. I don't remember what it's called. I think it's now Silicon for Silicon Valley with Adam Savage. And they just recently announced a couple of weeks ago that they're going to do it one weekend in August. And so both Adara and I will be there, you know, with Shy Ninja on the table, along with the other stuff I've worked on.
Will this be the first time you've been at a con as a vendor?
Oh, no. This would be, well, I don't know. I've been going for a few years. Well, I've done, you know, some books for publishers. I've also done quite a few things that I just did on my own. And they were projects that either didn't have sufficient commercial appeal, but I wanted to do anyway. Or I did a Kickstarter with a guy named Mark Teixeira. And so we used cons as a way to drive funding for that. We lined them up in time. But I also just find, even that if I bring books that I did do with a publisher, that it's a really fun way just to hear real feedback from people about what are they reading, what do they like, what do they think of your work, you know, if they happen to pick it up. And it's also a fun way to experience a con. like I've been on the other side of the table walking around, which is great. But at some point I wanted to get the experience of, you know, what's it like to sit next to an artist and that I've never met and who I would never have another opportunity to spend 48 hours, you know, next to, just to get to know somebody in that way. And so it's also been fun in that regard.
I've never been to a con as a vendor or a presenter, so I have no idea what that's like. But I imagine it's a bit of an endurance test to just sit there basically all day long and talk to people.
It can be, yeah. I'm pretty chatty, and
I can tell. I can definitely tell.
The last con I went to as a vendor, I'm trying to remember which one it was. It was either the Silicon, or it might have been the last. San Diego Comic-Con, but a lot of people, especially artists who are better known, they'll sit and they'll wait for people to come to them. Writers, especially in comics, don't necessarily have that luxury. They may know who I am, but they probably don't. And because I'm not an artist and I can't do a sketch in their sketchbook and I can't sell them a print, it's a much harder sell just in general to get them interested in anything I might have. So I will stand at my table. And I will, you know, point to my wares and I will literally pitch people like a barker to see if I have something that they might want to take a look at. And it is definitely an endurance test. At the end of it, I'm usually pretty hoarse and not much voice left. But it's also really fun to talk to people, even when they buy nothing, even if they're like, oh, this is interesting. And I have a project where often people will pick it up and literally read the whole thing and put it back down and walk away. But I get this reward where they're reading it and laughing the whole time.
Still, if you're going to read the whole thing, you may as well buy it. I mean, come on.
But they read the whole thing.
Yeah, it's something. Yeah. One thing that I've seen is that you sort of take your victories where you can get them. You know, like not everything's going to be a sale, but at least now this is known to them. So maybe they'll follow it on, you know, Instagram or Twitter, they'll follow your stuff, they'll read some more of it, maybe eventually they'll actually buy it. But man, I think if I were in your shoes and someone read the whole thing and left, I'd be like, dude, come on, really? You're gonna walk away?
Well, you know, years ago, I wrote plays. And the only reason to write a play, honestly, is because you get the real-time feedback of seeing it performed and the audience reaction to it. And it's really magical when, you know, to hear words you've written spoken by someone else, and then maybe the person you're sitting next to laughing aloud or tearing up because of these words you wrote. And you don't get that writing comic books for the most part, because you sell it, they go away, they read it, maybe they comment on a message board that they liked it. I don't really mind too much if somebody like reads through my work and has a real visceral reaction to it, because then I at least get the reward of seeing like how did the words I put together impact this human in the moment they read it, that I can't get any other way.
I get you. How did it feel to have this thing done, especially where this was you and your daughter working together?
I'm a little sad.
I can see that. I can see that because this was like your thing, your chance to work together and bond a little bit. And yeah, now that's over.
It is. And, you know, I hope we'll do something else together, but having a forcing function of, a writer's deadline and things like that really, really helped kind of get her to, you know, not want to spend her time doing something else like doodling or talking to friends or, you know, going to a movie. It was like, hey, we got to do this. So this weekend, you and me are going to sit down for a couple hours and it's hard to now get that attention from her. I mean, she is a teenager. She's getting older. She's got friends of her own. So I can't make those demands. So it's a little bittersweet. It was fabulous to get it out in the world, because now I get to see how people react to it. But also, I missed that ability to work with her that I had.
You could always do a sequel.
Fingers crossed. I'm super, super hopeful that enough people read it, that it does well enough that Humanoids wants to do more. Because without giving away the ending, I have already like set it up so that I already know like the entire plot for a sequel, who the villain is, what's going to happen. I like totally unexpected plot twists ready to go. So it's ready, if the audience is there for it.
I think it really does have a lot of legs to have like a second part. I mean, like the ending, again, not gonna give it away, but it ends in a very solid way. You know, it's not like cliffhanger, who knows what's gonna happen next, buy the next volume, you know. It's, but yeah, I could definitely see like another one. I could see the whole series, actually.
I definitely wanted the ending to be satisfactory. Like, I wanted people to feel a moment of closure without at the same time feeling like there was nothing else for these characters going forward. So the way, at least in my head, that I was thinking about it was very much like the older Bond movies, where this particular installment is over, but I mean, it's still Bond. And in this case, there's still a Shy Ninja who has these abilities, but also still has her anxiety disorder and still has her friend in a bubble. And you know, it's still there. Like there definitely could be more trouble coming her way.
All right. Well, Rick, this has been a lot of fun. Again, I am loving the series. Where do folks go to learn more about you and check out the work?
You can check out the work almost anywhere at the moment, fortunately, because Humanoids has done such a good job of getting it out there. For me, it's ricardo-sanchez.com is a great place to go. If you wanted to see some of Adara's art, she's on Instagram, Weird Squid Creature. Creature is with a K. You can catch me in both places. I'm also on Facebook as writer Ricardo Sanchez. And I'd love to hear from anyone who reads the book, because like I said, as a writer, you get so little like real feedback from people that knowing if a story impacted them is always fantastic to hear, even if they hate it.
On that note, Rick, again, man, awesome talking to you. The comic is amazing. And I sincerely hope that we'll be talking again for volume 2.
Awesome. Thank you so much, man.
Picture this. You finished your first book and nailed it. The plot, the characters, all the twists and turns. This one's a winner, and all you need is the right cover. If you've got my art skills, this is the part where panic usually sets in. Enter the cover villain, hero to writers everywhere. Founded by noted author Remy Flagg, Cover Villain focuses on composite image covers for science fiction and fantasy writers. Give them the details, and they'll craft a cover using popular trends that everyone will want to see. But wait, you say, I've got ideas of my own. No problem, as Cover Villain loves a good collaboration. As they say, our goal is to put a little villain in every cover we make. Want to know more? Then head to covervillain.com and follow them on Facebook and Instagram. Now, next up, I welcome back Wallace to the show. I last had her on to talk about her debut single, Lonely Christmas, which saw a huge response with tens of thousands of listens, over a million views of her music video on YouTube. And she joins me to talk about her brand new single, Another Day. Now, there was a lot of pressure after the huge success of the first song. And we talk about that, the recording process, which was quite the adventure for the family, and what it was like having her two sisters on the track. And well, folks, she is back. I am joined by a Pennsylvania-based artist, Wallace, to talk about her brand new single, Another Day, which was just released a little while ago.
Thank you, Max. Thanks for having me.
Of course. Now, last time we talked about your debut single, Lonely Christmas, which was a phenomenal hit, tens of thousands of listens on Spotify, more than a million views of your video on YouTube for this. So my question to you to kick this off with is that when it came to releasing Another Day, was there any concern about, okay, can we follow up on that kind of success?
Well, the one thing about Another Day is I was thinking about the direction that it would head, you know, considering the people listening to it. I was wondering, is it going to attract the same audience? Are the people that like Lonely Christmas going to like Another Day as well? Because it is kind of different. It is a little bit more, I guess you could say, poppy. But it also incorporates sort of a few different genres, all blended into one. But, you know, once Lonely Christmas came out, there was a lot of pressure to put out a song right away because people were like, okay, now you have this great song. You've got all these eyes on you. You got to put out something before it goes away, so you know you can maintain this audience. And I didn't expect Lonely Christmas to blow up the way it did. So all of a sudden there was that pressure to put something out. And of course, I don't want to put anything out until I'm happy with it. I'm not just, you know, I want to be proud of my content. So my dad and I, we threw together another day. We worked pretty hard on it. It took a couple extra months than we expected, but yes. So anyway, I think people will like it. I'm really hoping that they will. We worked really hard on it, and I don't know. I think it might attract some different audiences, and maybe some people that like Lonely Christmas will also like this. And yeah, I can only hope that it would have a portion of the response that Lonely Christmas had. So.
Oh yeah, definitely. And I definitely get what you're saying about wanting to maintain that audience. Like, you had such a huge following for this song, and now there's almost that pressure. Like, okay, keep it going. You can't stop. You can't take a break. And you didn't, actually. In fact, you actually recorded this thing while you were on vacation in Miami. That is dedication. How did all that come about?
Yes. So after Lonely Christmas was put out, we had planned a trip to Miami way before anything happened with Lonely Christmas. So we went to Miami, and this is when a new song was in high demand from everyone. So my dad and I were like, okay, I guess we got to bring some equipment with us to Miami so we can work on it while we're away. And this was during, you know, the time of COVID and everything. So we weren't really like seeing a bunch of people or doing any of that type of stuff. So we're like, okay, we can probably just stay where we're staying and write. And then it got to a point where we're like, okay, we don't have all of the equipment that we need, and we did the best that we could to use the equipment that we had with us to make a sort of makeshift studio. But then we realized Criteria Recording Studios was very close to us, which is this phenomenal recording studio in Miami. And my dad called, and he was just like curious. He's like, do you have any availability? He told them our situation, how we have this song that we got to get done. And Criteria was incredibly flexible with us, and they provided us with a lot of really great resources. And I was just so happy to have the opportunity to go there, because there's so many legendary people that got to record in Criteria. And when I arrived there, there weren't a whole lot of people there. We had an engineer that we worked with named Carlos Alvarez, and he was masked. And then we had an assistant engineer who was also masked up. So it was really only me and my dad, and then these two other people in the room. We're like, okay, if we all have masks, this seems like it will be safe. So anyway, we recorded that there, and it was so crazy because they told me that Nicki Minaj had just recorded a couple weeks before me. And I was like, okay, well, this is crazy, because you know, I'm so new to all of this. And I also had a ton of interviews at the time for the first time. Lonely Christmas was really my first set of interviews for a song. So I was still navigating all of that. And then I got to record at this legendary studio, and it was a really crazy experience. And then the assistant engineer ended up getting COVID, so we all had to get rapid tested, and I got tested outside of the parking lot. My dad and I were both negative, but we were really concerned for him. We wanted to make sure everyone was safe. Anyway, and then we didn't go back because we wanted to make sure everyone was safe because of that. But anyway, that was a whirlwind of a story, but that was a major part of making the song.
Jeez. that's a crazy story, though. I mean, like, you get there, you know, in the midst of this pandemic, you gotta take all these precautions, and then all of a sudden someone's sick. It's like, oh god, are we all sick too? You gotta get tested, man. But you got it done, and it sounds amazing. Yeah. One thing I was curious about, you mentioned the interviews, and I imagine you've done a ton of those. Has that been tricky to navigate, you know, to try and like learn how to do an interview? Because I know it's a bit of an art form too.
Oh my gosh, yes. I think interviews are very difficult. And usually it takes me a little bit of time to get comfortable throughout the interview. Usually I have a rough start in the beginning of the interview because I'm still processing my thoughts. And then once I become more comfortable, that's when the things that I'm actually trying to say come out. And yeah, you know, I get a little bit anxious before certain interviews. I want to make sure I'm saying the right things. But I'm just trying to not put too much pressure on myself. And I'm trying to just enjoy the process and, you know, say what is important to me and what I think needs to be said. And yeah, you know, I'm learning each time that I do one. I was 15 when I did, you know, it was only like, probably around 6 months ago when I did my first interviews, and that came very rapidly. It was like, okay, here's your first interview, and now here's five more this week. And I was like, what? Like, I don't know how to do this. And you know, I've been talking to people, and they're like, you know, you're not interviewing for a job. Like, you're talking to them. They want to know what you are like. Like, you're not, it's a different dynamic that I'm just trying to get used to. Yeah, anyway, but it's fun, and I'm just trying to navigate it.
All right. I want to ask next about the style for this song, because it's such a shift. Like, it opens in a very like mellow kind of like, I would say like slow start, but then it picks up really fast with a much more like poppy upbeat thing. Was that the original plan? Did you kind of want to do this like a combination of styles?
Yes. Well, I don't know if it's ever our original intent. We're never like, okay, we're going to try to blend together all of these styles. It sort of just flows along the process. And then if we enjoy something, we're like, okay, then we'll add this and we'll see how we can fit this in. And, oh, that sounds nice. That instrument enhances this part of the song very well. And like you're saying, like the beginning, it does have a sort of slower, more, I guess, dramatic and like dystopian sound. And then suddenly the beat kicks in and it is more rapid, and then there's like all these different instruments, and then it builds, and then it goes into more of a like a bass section, and then it, you know, has some dramatic moments within that, and then it goes sort of jazzy, and it has some like street jazz music in there, and then there are horns, and then there's even a little part where I do scatting, and then there's even a little line that I say in Spanish where I'm sort of rapping in Spanish. I don't think the original intent was ever to blend all of the different genres, but that has been outcome. And we usually like to incorporate different things that we enjoy listening to, like from different artists that we like. And you know, you find your inspirations from everywhere. So yeah, whatever we end up liking, we find a way to fit it all in.
And I think it's kind of good to experiment with different sounds, because you're really, I think, still at the beginning of your music career. So there's, you can like mess around, try new things. Is there a style that you think is yours?
I think it's sort of hard for me to label what style I would be categorized as right now, just because I am exploring, you know, I'm in the beginning of my career and I am exploring all of these different music genres and styles. And since I do like to blend some of these genres together, I don't know exactly where that would be placed. Right now, a lot of the music that we're putting out and working on, I think would fall more under the pop category, and then it just, you know, we infuse some different genres in there, but generally it will be pop. But I have a feeling in the future I will write a wider variety than just pop, because we've got some songs in the works that I would not consider pop. So, you know, who knows?
Really? I'm very curious now, because Lonely Christmas was definitely more of like a pop tune, a holiday song. And then this was such a different sound, like, especially when I got the opening. I was like, okay, this is gonna be a little more mellow. And then, oh no, it's actually gonna be something different. And then, like you said, you had this jazz and the scatting and the Spanish. Are you fluent in Spanish?
No, I'm not fluent in Spanish. I wish I was, but I was actually very hesitant on doing the Spanish line, because I was like, is it like, I'm not fluent? Is this, I don't know. Like, it just felt weird to me. And I was like, is this like phony of me if I speak a line in Spanish and I don't speak Spanish? But I have family who's from Argentina, and my grandmother speaks fluent Spanish, and I have a lot of family members who do speak fluent Spanish. And I was like, I think they will really appreciate it. And also Carlos, one of the engineers that I worked with in Miami, he produces Latin music, and he was like, no, you got to keep it. And then all of these people who I've been working with and that are my family and loved ones, they all were like, no, we like the Spanish. You got to keep the Spanish. And I was like, all right, if everyone's telling me I got to keep the Spanish, I might as well, you know?
I thought it sounded authentic to me. Like, it really sounded like, I'm actually surprised to hear that you're not fluent, because you sounded very, very fluent there.
That makes me feel so good, because I was so conscious of how I was going to pronounce every single word. And I was, that was a big thing for me. And I was working with Carlos on it. I was like, can you please make sure I'm pronouncing everything correctly? And he actually said to me, he was like, well, you know, Spanish speakers are usually more forgiving of other people speaking Spanish than English speakers are of other people trying to speak English with an accent. Does that make sense, what I just said?
It does. It does. And I think it's definitely showing the country's bias a little bit.
Yeah. But, you know, I was just like, okay, if everyone's going to encourage it, I'll try my best and I'll try to get it right. And yeah.
All right. Now, this song once again features your two sisters. They were in the video for A Lonely Christmas, and they're actually singing on this track. How would you say your chemistry is as singers?
Well, a big thing that we actually were focusing on in Miami and just generally throughout our singing career together is we actually watched the Bee Gees documentary together while we were in Miami. We all watched it as a family, and a huge part of the Bee Gees documentary discussed the blend of siblings and how when siblings sing together, they have, you know, they're related by blood. They have this blend and bond that can't really be anything but your family. And when we sing together, even though we all have very different voices on our own, there is a blend that just comes naturally. And the more that we work on it, the stronger that it gets. And I think that was one of the main things that we were really trying to focus on with this song, because in Lonely Christmas, we harmonize together a lot. And in this song, we also harmonize together a lot. And I think we're just constantly working on finding the best blend for everyone. And there's something really special about singing with other people. That's one of my favorite things, regardless of if it's my sisters or, you know, anyone who can sing, I really enjoy it. But it really is a powerful thing and a meaningful thing to me that I get to sing with my sisters.
So. Excellent. Excellent. So what is next for you?
Well, next for me in terms of my career or in terms of my life, because I'm about to go off the grid for 2 months and no phone or anything. And I'm going to stay in a tent with my friends so I can have a, you know, social media free summer and enjoy the world in a different way. But in terms of my career, I am working on more music. I recorded another song earlier today with my dad, and we're constantly writing and we're trying to put out a couple songs this year. So I'm excited for that.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, Wallace, as always, it's great talking to you. I am loving the new song. And where do folks go to learn more about you?
You can follow my Spotify, which is just Wallace, W-A-L-L-I-S. It's in all caps. And my Instagram is currently at @I_am_Wallace. That could change to just at Wallace if we can get the handle. but pretty much all of my social media profiles are either just Wallace in all caps or I_am_Wallace.
Until next time.
Thank you so much, Max.
Hi, this is singer Kate Eppers, and you're listening to Citywide Blackout.
All right, everyone, that brings this episode to a close. Don't forget to follow the show on Facebook under Citywide Blackout and Twitter and Instagram under Citywide Max. Listen to the show wherever you get your podcast enjoyment. And if you want to be on the show or can recommend someone, you get at me at citywidemax@yahoo.com. I'll be ending this with a brand new single from Wallace, Another Day, and I absolutely love the fusion of styles in this song. I think you'll enjoy it. As always, keep those ears open.
Pennies in my pocket, got holes in my pants. White shoes, denim blues, I just wanna dance.
I'm spinning on this axis, paying taxes, taking classes. I stare into the blackness through rose-colored glasses. I'm dancing through another day. Clear eyes synthesize with my heart is full.